It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
That's good. That's unison.
I'm still coming down from the sugar high from Thursday.
Yeah,
we just skipped dinner and went straight to all the desserts.
Oh, my.
I haven't slept since then, by the way. And if I'm talking really fast, you know why.
Seems to be the theme today, everyone coming in without sleep. So let's jump into things. The Medicare was a big issue. Got coverage in the press a lot this week, although not a lot of illumination on what really happened.
Yeah, actually, it may be the last time you hear or see the word coverage in a long time. It's enough to make you sick, but get better by 2006. The energy bill was, I think it was Barney Frank, somebody, one of the Democrats labeled the energy bill the no lobbyists left behind bill. This was the no lobbyists left behind part two act of 2003. It was, you know, between this and the energy bill and the defense appropriations bill, the military appropriations bill, you know, you used to have Republicans decrying Democratic-laden pork bills in Congress. It's actually gotten far worse in the last two or three years, particularly. And this bill was a particular example of that, but it was also very specific to the pharmaceutical industry, the extension of prescription drug benefits to seniors. It's a $400 billion bill, and of that, $139 billion, that's B as in billion, that's $139 with what, nine zeros after it, I think that's right. Yeah, is going directly into the pockets of the pharmaceutical industry, which is already the most profitable after tax in major industry in the United States at 38%. I'm sorry, after tax profits last year. These folks are getting 1/3 of the money that is being spent in what is one of the highest tickets bills to come down the pike in a while. Meantime, it does very little in terms of improving the actual coverage of prescription drugs for seniors or the disabled.
I think the worst.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think the worst part of this bill is that there are simply no cost controls. Now the Democrats.
No, none. It'll get worse.
Yeah. Now the Democrats and some of the other groups that were lobbying on this bill wanted limits on increases in premiums and deductibles. Now, if you remember. A little bit of insurance talk here. Premiums are what you pay in order to have your insurance. That's what you pay to the insurance company for them to provide you the benefits. The deductible is what you have to pay out of your pockets before you get any coverage at all from the insurance company. Now, both of those are set to increase over the 8 years that the bill is going to be in effect from 2006 to 2013. And there are no guarantees that the premiums themselves, the monthly premiums, are going to be $35 a month, which is the number that the Republicans have used to say, well, it's only going to cost, you know, X amount for you to have this coverage. There's no guarantee that it's only going to be $35 a month. In fact, it's likely to be much higher because insurance premiums are going up steadily and have gone up by double digits every year since
the early
1990s.
Much higher than the rate of inflation.
Right. And there's nothing in the bill to keep those costs in check. Now, the bill also includes this enormous coverage gap. I have never seen private insurance include a coverage gap that like this bill has. It simply makes no sense. Now, a quick explanation of that is if once you have paid your premiums and you've paid the $250 deductible, Medicare will cover 75% of your costs up to $2,000. Between $2,000 and $5,000 of your costs, there's no coverage. Seniors will have to pay that completely out of their own pocket. So Medicare will not cover any of that. If you have costs over $5,000, then that 95% coverage kicks in. So it makes no sense. I've never seen any insurance plan, any private insurance plan structured in this fashion. And it's going to be extremely confusing for seniors to try to sit down with a calculator. Many seniors have supplemental insurance to cover their drug costs already, either through an employer or through a private company that they pay a premium to every month for supplemental insurance. They'll have to sit down with a calculator and try to figure out which one gives them a better deal. And it's going to be extremely complicated and extremely difficult for them to figure out what their total costs are going to be under this. Now, the problem here also is that many employers who offer supplemental insurance to their retired workers or their elderly workers or their disabled workers will look at this Medicare plan and say, well, I don't have to offer that anymore. And they'll cut it out. And a lot of people will lose much better coverage that they get through their employers or through private companies than they then will be able to. They'll lose that much better coverage that they get through their employers, and they'll have to go on this Medicare coverage, which really stinks when you look at the numbers and the amounts that people will have to pay.
Yeah, it really is a bill in the way that it is structured that is laden with incentives for people to walk away from the Medicare program entirely and to try and seek out their primary coverage through private carriers. And unfortunately, obviously, there's no cost controls over that either. And the way it's likely to pan out, I suspect, is that you're going to get the same handful of large companies that can currently control the market in different states. For instance, if you want to get individual supplemental policies in this state right now, you have Premera or you have Regents. Those are basically the two options in Washington State. A lot of states are like that, and those same companies are going to be able to calibrate what they charge through the Medicare premiums and the supplemental policies so that it's a bad deal either way.
Right.
So I was doing the math over here while you were talking, so take it with a grain of salt. But if it's 75% on the first 2,000 and then zero coverage on 2 to 5, we're looking at basically for the first 5,000, then you're only looking at 30% coverage.
Yeah.
That's about right. That's correct.
That's
lame. Extremely lame.
And for any kind of serious health care issue, as anybody who's gotten sick recently knows, if you have a hospital stay of more than a couple of days, you're over that $5,000. It adds up very, very
quickly.
With
all the stuff they pump into. Yeah, this is for prescription drug coverage. Yeah, but with all the medicines you'd have to use, all the IVs, et cetera, you'd be over that amount.
That's what I was
referring
to.
Now, there are other problems with the bill, too, as far as cost controls. Now, I talk about the $2,000 to $5,000 gap. That's not always going to stay the same. That gap will increase. So when you see costs that are calculated in the newspaper, they're looking at the first year that the bill is going to be in effect. They're looking at 2006 costs. They're not looking at 2013 costs. For example, on the eighth year of the plan, when that coverage gap will widen, when the deductible will get larger. So the deductible will not always be $250. The deductible will increase by 78%. So in 2013, the deductible will go from $250 to $450. So those costs increase, the out-of-pocket costs that seniors will have to pay in this coverage. It really is very lousy. It's linked to the projected increase in inflation. The costs are linked to increases in retail costs of drugs. These are things that were written in by the Republicans in order to ensure that drug companies will benefit from this plan more so than the people that it's supposed to really benefit, senior citizens. Now, the Republicans, also drafted language in the bill that not only privatizes the benefit, so it takes it out of the province of Medicare itself and allows private insurance companies to offer the benefit, a lesser benefit than they offer currently to most people, to senior citizens. But it also prevents the government from negotiating better deals with drug companies themselves. And it also prevents the government, also prevents Medicare, from buying cheaper drugs abroad, particularly in Canada, and trying to resell them to senior citizens at a lower cost. So it eliminates those cost controls, too.
And this is a major, major area of cost control because the federal government at present is one of the, if not the, largest bulk purchaser of drugs in the country.
That's right.
Between the VA system and all the other various agencies that,
right.
And that it the
opens,
government
it
buys
opens,
drugs.
Yeah, it opens up the door for lawsuits as well on the state level. Because there are some state plans that are trying to do that kind of bulk purchasing of cheaper drugs from Canada to resell to their plan members. And if it's going to be prohibited at the federal level, there's a question of whether pharmaceutical companies might sue states that want to do that and say, well, it's prohibited at the federal level. How can you do it at the state level?
It's amazing. Well, on the one hand, though, you could say not allowing the federal government to negotiate, you know, further based on this negotiation they just did, maybe that's a good thing, you know, take them out of the loop.
Well, but at least the American Association of Republican Patsies will be able to sell their insurance.
Well, speaking of a similar acronym, AARP, I understand there's been a lot of card burning this week. People very upset with leadership.
Yeah, as they should be. Although, I have to say, and I think we mentioned this last week, or I mentioned it somewhere that I was talking, that it's not unusual now for these large and not Beltway-based nonprofits to really be hooked into corporate funding. You have the cancer societies that don't talk about the environmental causes of cancer. You have big green groups that don't talk about resource consumption and our emphasis on materialism, Happy Buy Nothing Day. It really has become a plague upon the nonprofit world, and the AARP endorsement of this bill was a spectacular example of that because it ran directly counter to the interest of their membership.
Yeah, and a lot of people might be scratching their heads. Why did the AARP endorse this bill? Well, the AARP has done what a lot of these large nonprofits do. They've done these things to expand their membership that has changed a little bit the demography of the people who belong to the AARP. Now, the AARP has dropped the age limit for people to join the plan, so there's an increasing number of people in the organization who are between the ages of 45 and 60. People for who don't remember what or don't really know why Social Security and Medicare were instituted in the first place, who aren't really looking at it in terms of, well, I've got to retire and it's going to affect my pocketbook, et cetera, et cetera. These are younger people are also used to paying more for their own health insurance. So
and people
a little
who've
more
never
accepting.
Been seriously ill sometimes, too.
That's right. People who have not hit that point where they're starting to have to spend a lot of money on medical costs. So those folks are more accepting of this plan than people who are older and actually have to pay for their health costs out of their retirement savings and out of their Social Security income.
All right. Anything else on that?
Well, and also the AARP sells insurance. That's something that they've done through the whole life of this association. They started out, in fact, as a company that provides insurance to its members that the government and that private other private organizations were not providing. And that's been a major focus of the AARP all along. They have a product that they need to sell, and that's their direct financial interest. Because this plan puts Medicare into the hands of private companies, of course the AARP was going to be for it.
Yeah, and it also has the AARP, the most widely read magazine in terms of circulation in the country, and is heavily stocked with pharmaceutical advertising, display ad and otherwise.
Yeah. All right. New potential feature question of the week. Maria, you have a question of the week.
Well, I thought, you know, after we'd been we hear a lot about the ravages of international terrorism and all of the people that Saddam Hussein was responsible for torturing and killing and how terrible that was, but there's something out there that kills 3 million people every year. Now, if you think about that, that's a lot of people that die every year from something that's preventable. And what is it? It's AIDS. Now, the UN has released a report this past week that was issued by its body, the UNAIDS group, that coordinates the treatment of AIDS around the world, that looked at the total of people who die every year and the people, new people who are infected every year from AIDS. It's now more than 3 million people each year that die of AIDS, and 5 million more acquire the HIV virus every year. That's brought the total number of infected people up to about 46 million worldwide.
Yes, many of whom do not have good prescription drug coverage.
That's right. Most of those people are living in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia and in countries where there is very little infrastructure for healthcare at all, much less low-cost AIDS medicines. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is doing its best to support pharmaceutical companies and undercut efforts to lower the cost of AIDS drugs worldwide. Also trying to undercut companies in India and Brazil that make generic AIDS treatments for the third world. And we're also spending some $70 billion plus dollars this year for our troops in Iraq. Now, about a third of that, somewhere around $20 billion, would go a very, very long ways in preventing the death of 3 million people every year. We're throwing it away on doing things like setting up barbed wire encampments around villages on the border between Iraq and Syria, because we're under some kind of impression that it's international terrorism that's responsible for the problems in Iraq, when that's not the case.
I got that impression from reading the papers.
It may be what you read in papers, but if you still pay attention to the press reports, you still hear commanders on the ground say, well, we haven't picked up any Syrians. We're picking up native Iraqis who are responsible for these attacks.
And when you see interviews with guerrillas, with resistance fighters in Iraq, too, particularly in the Middle Eastern press, they will say this is homegrown. We don't want foreign fighters particularly.
Well, that obviously brings us into this week in Iraq, and of course the thing that made the television sets in the newspapers was Bush's appearance there all of a sudden on Thursday.
Yeah, and then he came back, which was really a shame, both because it would have been interesting to see him in Baghdad after dark, and because, of course, he came back here. Everything that George Bush says and does regarding Iraq is intended for an American audience. It is not intended for people in the rest of the world, let alone people in Iraq. And the coverage of a number of the things that Bush has done recently, including his visit on Thursday, has been just excoriating in the Muslim press in the world. And if you go online, you can see a number of the newspapers from that part of the world, IRNA.com from Tehran and Al Aram from Cairo, Dawn from Pakistan, and the Daily Star in Beirut. Daily Star had an editorial regarding the election plan, which we'll talk about in a minute, basically saying that it looked an awful lot like a treaty that was negotiated between the Americans and the Indians in the 1880s. And you know, that also tells you that, you know, people in that part of the world know more about American history than we know about theirs. But Bush's trip to Iraq was deeply symbolic on a number of levels, not the least of which was that he has it was insulting to Iraqis. He went to Iraq. He was there for 2 hours. He had no contact with people of Iraq themselves.
He never left Baghdad International Airport.
Never left the airport. We'll talk about that in a second. But here you've got a leader of the free world who, for one thing, is afraid to come out from behind the barbed wire encampment at the airport. But beyond that, he's promising democracy and openness, yet he is afraid to go anywhere near the actual people of Iraq. And that is not a message that was lost.
Part of the reason he never left Baghdad International Airport, other than because 2 days earlier the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw stayed overnight in Baghdad, and the area where he stayed was hit by a couple of missiles while he was there. And he was actually there in secret, so it's pretty obvious that the guerrillas have better intelligence than we give them credit for. That's one of the reasons Bush stayed at Baghdad International Airport. But the other reason he did was because this week two pipelines were on fire again in Iraq because of sabotage. And there was a blackout in Baghdad. And because there was no power, there was no way they were gonna take
him. People in Baghdad didn't even know he was there.
Yeah, and the people in Baghdad on Thursday didn't even know he was there. It wasn't until power was restored on Friday and they could turn on their TV sets that they saw that, oh, George Bush was in town.
Yeah, talk about lost opportunities for them. But it really is falling down in a number of ways. You know, the whole promise that Bush has made that we're going to pull out and there's going to be self-governance in Iraq. Well, suddenly they're talking about, well, we can't have elections that quickly. And they've done this jerry-rigged thing of having caucuses around the country, using people who have been handpicked by the Americans as participants in the caucuses in order to determine the constitution and the future government of Iraq.
Set up the new interim legislature, which is supposed to take control from the U.S. authority in June of next
year. We're talking about 8 months from now, and there is no infrastructure for any of that. And meantime, you have the country's leading Shiite cleric coming out, and then other clerics following his suit and saying, "No, this plan is unacceptable. We want full and fair and free elections," which of course is exactly what the Americans have been promising. And so now you have the Bush administration in this impossible bind of saying, the Iraqis aren't ready for elections. And if you look at this morning's New York Times, there's this priceless quote from an analyst sympathetic to the Bush administration who is saying something like, "Well, it puts the administration in a difficult position because if they have elections too quickly, the wrong person might get elected."
Well, we know about that firsthand.
Yeah, we do, don't we? It's sort of like Catherine Harris saying, "Well, if we allow a full and fair recount of the votes, the wrong person might get elected." It really is telling, because, of course, in a democracy, you shouldn't have to have control over whether the right person or the wrong person gets elected as who the people of Iraq want, right? Well, no. Well, Washington obviously has no interest whatsoever in allowing anybody but somebody sympathetic to the Americans,
of course, the main
to have control, and the Shiites do not want that at all.
The main
they're the majority.
The main fear. The Shiites make up about a 60% majority in the country, and the main fear is because the Shiites are closely related to the population of Iran, and that many of them are
well organized.
Yeah, and many of them are very religious. The fear is that they'll elect a leader who will be sympathetic to Iran and not to U.S. interests. So that's why the U.S. has a vested interest in preventing any kind of elections in Iraq, particularly elections right now, before the U.S. is able to set up its own puppet government. And, of course, we talked about it last week, too, that in the selection process that the U.S. wants to do, it's sort of a job security program for the returning exiles that the U.S. wants to promote. We talked about that last week.
But what we're coming to here is that the Iraqi National Council, which was supposed to be the first effort at self-rule, has zero legitimacy among Iraqis. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. As is true for most of these exiles that the United States has been promoting, Chalabi and all the rest of them. It's becoming problematic whether anybody that the Americans would support could actually get elected in a fair and full and free election. And this is part of the bind that the Bush administration is in also, because the longer that they wait before elections and the fiercer the resistance gets, because it is going to get stronger rather than weaker as time goes on, the more likely it is that anybody that the Americans support is going to be viewed very, very skeptically by Iraqis who look at what the Americans and pursuing American interests has brought their country to already.
All right. And Maria, the Iraqi police.
Oh, yes. I wanted to talk a little bit about there's this notion that the attacks that the U.S. has been doing in Iraq, these operations in order to clamp down on the terrorists, are actually having some effect. Well, they're having a little bit of effect in Baghdad. That's a little bit like Afghanistan, actually, where the U.N. controls Kabul, but not the countryside.
Yeah, only at daytime.
Right, and in fact, the divisions that are stationed in the Sunni Triangle have reported that they have seen no decrease in attacks on U.S. troops because of these operations.
Yeah, in fact, it's continuing to go up a little bit.
And in fact, it's continuing to increase there, as it has been over the past couple of months. Now, there is another part of the country. There's another way in which the attacks are increasing as well. There are more attacks against Iraqi police and against Iraqi officials who support the U.S. coalition. Now, the police in particular were a target this last week of two devastating car bombings that killed somewhere around 18 people, including two very young children, and wounded more than 50 people. They've also, guerrillas have also killed a police colonel who was in charge of forces that guard the Iraqi pipelines and oil installations. And a police chief was killed in Latifia, which is near Baghdad, a town near Baghdad. Now, the Iraqi police are starting to complain about all this violence and the lack of support from the U.S. They say they have very little equipment. We heard last week how there are no police cars in Mosul, so U.S. Black Hawk helicopters have to chase gunmen and bank robbers. And there's very little in the way of advanced intelligence gathering equipment. There aren't even any barriers or anti-terrorist structures in front of police stations. So it's very, very easy for car bombs to approach and destroy police stations. That's become a favorite technique of the guerrillas. Now, what impact is this having on U.S. efforts to recruit Iraqi forces to police their own country? Well, the Bush administration has admitted that they need about 100,000 police in order to take over from U.S. Troops. How many do they have in training? They've got about 10,000. That's about one-tenth of what they need. And the Boston Globe had a report on Iraqi police saying that they're losing hundreds of people from the Iraqi police forces who are quitting their jobs because of all of the violence. So that initiative to hand over some of the security issues in Iraq to Iraqi police, that's pretty much going down the tubes right now.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. Job, you were going to talk about Georgia.
Just very briefly, because we wanted to get to an event plug as well. But for people who are concerned about Asia and about things like oil, pay attention also to what is happening in the country, not the state, but the country of Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, where Eduard Shevardnadze, the former communist boss who has been essentially the dictator of that country for the past, 11 years, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, basically was forced out of power last week, and he was he's been backed for a long time by the United States. In fact, there are American troops in Georgia now for the first time ever, because last year Shevardnadze and the Bush administration came to an agreement, the Bush administration wanting to help out Georgia and Russia to flesh out so-called Chechen terrorists who've been operating across the border and in Georgia, which is not right next to Chechnya, but relatively close by.
So, do you think that's really true, or do you think that's just an excuse to station troops there?
No, it's an excuse to station troops there. And the reason, as I mentioned before, was oil.
Yeah.
There is a pipeline from Azerbaijan, where the Caspian Sea area, where tremendous reserves have been discovered. The Americans would very much like a pipeline to be built that does not go through Russia, that does not allow Russia to have direct control over those resources.
And does not go through a major Islamic country like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah. And so Shevardnadze had backed that plan. The Americans now have found the opposition leader who took over, Mikhail Saakashvili. Is that correct?
We were
having debate over the
Saakashvili.
That was it.
Like that.
We were having debate over the pronunciation earlier. He is presumably in favor of democracy and yada yada. But what he's really in favor of is the oil pipeline. He has given assurances to Washington that the oil pipeline project will proceed apace. Look for another dictatorship to be set up in Georgia, and one that is very favorable to American and oil interests. That's the bottom line.
All right. Finally, event coming up this week.
Yes, Tariq Ali, Tariq Ali. I keep saying Tajik, and I should know better because I interviewed him this week. I talked to him on the phone from London.
It's talking about those former Soviet republics.
Exactly, Tajikistan. So Tariq Ali, he has his own country in Central Asia, and he's actually for people who've heard him on Democracy Now or David Barsamian has interviewed him. He's been on various lefty things. He's He's a British activist and scholar, former Pakistani exile, who has been writing fiction and nonfiction and other wonderful things. Has a new
wonderful
book out.
Essays.
A new book out, Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, and he is in town next weekend on
next
the 5th
Saturday,
and 6th.
Next Saturday he will be speaking from 7 to 9 at Keystone United Church in
Wallingford. And he also, I believe, has readings at both Elliott Bay and UW Bookstore.
Very good. All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you can pick up free publications around town. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you have story ideas, or you want to just tell us what stupid jerks we are, you can call us.
which Central Asian country to go to?
That's right. You can leave a message on our voicemail at 206-903-9461.